Crumb.
Oh yeah.
Let's go ahead and jump into it. Does that sound good to you guys?
I like it.
I'm pro.
All right.
It's a sound plan.
It's a good plan. We're going to stick with the plan. Welcome back, everybody. Thorough. Welcome back, everybody, to the Savage Chromcast. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke.
I'm Josh.
I am Jonathan.
Oh, and we three kings, we three saucy, salty sons of
sorcerers,
sons of darkness are your hosts this season. What's the season number, guys?
Lucky
14,
number,
right?
Lucky number 14.
we are lucky number 13 this season, correct?
That's right.
This is the luckiest of numbers across the entirety of the infinitude of numerals that exist. And for this season, we chose to discuss Cain, who is a creation by Carl Edward Wagner. Isn't that right, y'all?
That's right.
It's true.
Cute. It's damn true. We're talking about Cain.
I see his initials a lot, and it's Cute.
Carl Edward Wagner. We've talked around this fellow a bit. He is a descendant within the lineage that we've talked about over the seasons, and he is a powerhouse within the field. You know, over the entirety of his career. Unfortunately, there's not more Wagner stories being written because he has shuffled off the mortal coil. But we're going to be talking about his sword and sorcery character, Cain, this season. And we're not talking about all the Cain stories. We're going to do it piecemeal. And specifically, we're going to talk about the short story collection entitled Night Winds from 1978. And then we're also going to talk about the novel Bloodstone. So similar to when we tackled Fawford and Mouser, you know, when we got into the library, we didn't tackle all the Fawford and Gray Mouser materials. We tackled sort of the first couple books. We're doing the same thing here with Cain. And so this will give us a taste. I think it'll be fun because Cain is a character that spans like space and time. So a lot of the stories are a bit disjunct anyway. We're gonna just tackle these two tomes. What else? I guess we can go ahead and jump into what we've been drinking on. So, John, were you pouring something there?
I just was. Yes, I was making a Luke cocktail. It's the bourbon mixed with lemon LaCroix, and it always makes me think of you.
What's the bourbon?
Oh, Wild Turkey 101.
Nice, doing the highball.
I'm a simple man.
What about you, Sir Josh?
Nice, man. We've been discussing secret plans for an upcoming project. At the beginning of this episode, and while we did that, I had a Leinenkugel Oktoberfest, and it's fine.
What kind of grade, you know, on the standard, like, student grades, what would you give it?
Student grades?
Yeah.
Man, it's no Sam Adams.
Mm-hmm.
It's no West 6th Donkashane, but it is good. It is good.
Would it get a passing grade?
Yeah, it passes.
All right, I would agree with that.
It shows up.
Yeah.
And so that was before we got on mic, and now I have a couple fingers of Maker's Mark.
Awesome, dude.
Which I don't often buy.
Cool. So I was drinking a Coors, the banquet beer, before we officially hit record. But at this point, I popped open the Grolsch top on one of the home brews. So I've got a bottle of my Metheglin that I brewed like early in spring of 2020, and it's ready for sipping on. So it's good. It's tasty. It's a bit sweet, and Yeah, it's easy drinking, so that's what I got going.
Nice.
Easy on the palate.
All right, so that's what we're drinking. How about we move on over to the one thing?
Nice.
John, do you have a one thing prepared for us?
I do have a one thing prepared for us today because I am a consummate podcast professional. My one thing is a book I've been reading by Anthony Bourdain. It's called A Cook's Travels or A Chef's Travels. And it's a sort of whirlwind tour of his around the world. And you just see his visits to all these different places that you see in the show and his sort of behind the scenes experiences in those different locales. I've been digging the Anthony Bourdain stuff lately. So that's what I've been thinking about.
Cool, man. It seems like you've used him as a one thing, or at least some of his material before. So
yeah,
you're on the Bourdain train.
I guess so. Yeah. I had never experienced him in the past. And then I read a comic book he wrote last year for Cromtober. That was one of my one things then. And then I kind of found out about his show after that. Is it No Reservations?
Yep.
And I've been really into it. I like his world weary yet also celebration of life kind of approach.
Dude, it's because you're a closet like punk. you've got that normie outward appearance, but underneath that milk chocolate like shell, you've got some wild in you.
Yeah, I got some punk gonzo aesthetic in my heart, I think.
You do. You heard it here. John is the gonzo of the Chromecast.
He's the gonzo.
I am the great gonzo.
The great gonzo.
I will be fired from a cannon now.
Yeah. Put that chicken down.
Josh, do you have a one thing?
I do. It's still spooky season. And I have been enjoying reading some selections from a book called Spookiest Stories Ever, Four Seasons of Kentucky Ghosts by Roberta Simpson Brown.
Nice.
And Lonnie E. Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have that too, John?
I read it last year during Cromtober season. So yeah, I'm acquainted.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Fast forwarded to the autumn ghosts, so they're sorted by season, and I've just been reading the ghosts of autumn, and they're super good. Some of them are less creepy than others. One of them that I enjoyed a lot was the story of someone swearing that they saw a person's torso with nothing above it climbing up out of Mammoth Cave, walking up the trail from the main entrance to the cave.
Yeah,
man, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, and it just walked on down the trail. So
that's the way to do it.
Yeah, if you're the bottom part of a body that doesn't have torso, yeah, what else can you do?
Right,
it's unfortunate because it's not even the situation where it's like a headless body that's like has hands to pick up said body and like place it back, you know, place the head back on a torsoless like set of legs. They're kind of SOL. They're just sort of wandering around.
Yeah. And no one ever tells ghostly stories around the campfire of the torsoless legs. The torsoless legmen.
I get no respect.
You can't even say that. You don't have a head.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
You just bumble and stumble into a tree.
You could tap it out in Morse code.
You could kick somebody really hard.
And how.
Anyway, I've been digging the local Kentucky ghost stories, especially the ones from towns that I've been to and buildings that I recognize.
Yeah, man, that's a good one. So it is still kind of a spooky season with our recordings here. And I would hazard to say that we're going to continue a spooky bit of stories here with Kane. Like he's got a touch of the melodrama and the goth in him, right?
It's true.
He's super spooky.
I love it.
None more black.
Yeah. So we're going all black. We're going all goth you know, for this season. But, you know, according to when this episode drops, it's probably going to be coming around right on the other side of Halloween, somewhere thereabouts anyway. So, yeah, it's spooky. So with my one thing, I have been watching the second season of Primal, which is phenomenal, in my opinion. I love it. I love the second season as much as I love the first season or even more. And the last episode that I watched last night was, I think, called Coven of the Damned. And it's about our protagonists being a caveman and a mama T-Rex wandering up on some spooky shit, some witches, like, having a sabbat out in the middle of nowhere. And it's very heartfelt. This new season, like every episode, and I think there's been three up to this point with the new season, leave me feeling like I just kind of want to cry, but also like take my spear and point it up at the sky and just like give a triumphant like yelp in a Dead Poet Society kind of fashion. I just want to let my yelp ring out. But also I kind of feel like I want to cry. It's really kind of sad and happy at the same time, and it's so good. But Primal just continues to kill it. And it's a bit spooky, always, but especially that episode, Coven of the Damned.
We're pro Tartakovsky on this podcast.
Oh, yes, deeply.
It really is. It's beautiful. The colors, the action, like the way it's presented. I think it will stand the test of time. I will love to see like what the kids say in 20 or 30 years from now, whenever, you know, it's the same age as something like heavy metal. Like it's going to be around, and it's going to be such a representation of that aesthetic, the same way that like the heavy metal movie was, you know, when it came out.
Yeah.
That's my one thing. So John had a one thing, Josh had a one thing, Luke had a one thing. You stir them all up in a pot and you got
one thing.
A one thing.
One thing gumbo.
Mmm. It's got all that. It's got all of our tastes are melded together.
Mm-hmm. Plus some bay leaves and some sausage.
You need those bay leaves. I don't quite know what bay leaves do. Do they add an extra layer of like just an unknown kind of spice to it?
Yeah, I think it's a little savory flavor.
Yeah. Bay leaves are a mystery to me. Whenever the recipes tell me to add them, I do, and then I pull them out as they instruct. Yeah. But I still don't understand the laurel, the bay.
They got a lot of lignin. You can't break that down in your digestive tract, Luke.
Maybe it's not meant to be understood.
That's it. Yeah, there it is. That's a Lovecraftian mystery of the universe.
The ultimate bay.
It's meant to be tasted.
we don't talk about the ultimate bay.
All right, let's talk about Cain. Q's Cain, if we can. I don't want to say that in a dismissive or derogatory fashion. The QQ, but Carl Edward Wagner's Cain is what we're getting into, and the first story that we're discussing tonight is entitled Undertow, which I think is a hell of a way to encounter Cain. It was the way that I encountered Cain. So I'll go ahead and say I've read this collection before. But with y'all, had you encountered this character previously?
No.
Yeah, my only encounters have been through your sort of rabid endorsements of him.
Yeah, my proselytizing.
Yeah, and promising that we would get to him eventually.
With me, I, in grade school, in elementary school, I went to a school whose mascot was the Vikings, and on the wall in our cafeteria was a mural of the Frazetta art that is on, maybe it's Darkness Weaves. It's the Viking version of Cain with like the blood dripping from his axe. And so that mural was there on my grade school cafeteria / basketball court wall. And later I saw that again on a Molly Hatchet album cover and was a little bit freaked out by like, you know, that's the Viking that freaked me out in my grade school lunchroom. And so later I learned that that was a Frazetta version of Kane.
Huh.
Yeah, but I had not read any of the stories. I know that Kane, or at least my preconceived notion of him, is that he is an anti-hero, but I guess that Wagner didn't like that designation very much, that he's not necessarily an anti-hero, but he's a gothic hero. He's sort of a tragic hero in a sense. And so I have never read anything prior to this in terms of Kane. And as I understand it, this is not chronologically the first Kane that was published, right? Like the first one was maybe Death Angel's Shadow.
So, yeah, so I don't know necessarily the publication history of when these specific collections came out. I just knew they were all like in the midst of the 70s during the back end of the like sword and sorcery craze.
Yeah.
Right. And the cool thing about these stories, similar to the Conan yarns, is that you can pick them up. You don't have to read them in sequence, obviously. You've got so the story of Kane that Carl Edward Wagner put together was three novels, two short story collections, and then a couple of other extra things that were out there, right? So you could say three short story collections, but really it was Bloodstone, Dark Crusade, and Darkness Weaves as the three novels, and then Death Angel's Shadow and Night Winds as the two short story collections. And then some years later, 8 years later specifically, in 1985, The Book of Kane came out, which includes reprints of a handful of materials plus Misericord and the other one, which are published in some latter horror anthologies that Kane was a part of, or mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that Wagner was a part of.
Yeah, it blurs the lines a little bit. And, but there are a couple of Kane stories that are not collected anywhere, I think. And I think one of them is Kane meeting up with Elric, mm-hmm. Of Melna Binet, and Moonglum, his buddy, and I don't think those are in any of these collections.
I think there's an Elric anthology that I've seen before that's like the various people sort of writing Elric, and I think that it's in that collection.
Okay, yeah, so it's accessible.
So that's what's cool about Kane as a character and Wagner's materials as an author. Is you can pick them up a lot of ways, but it's also infuriating in that there are no Del Reys for Carl Edward Wagner's Kane. There's Centipede Press editions of things. There are complete publications, but they are expensive. And if you're going to delve back into the used paperbacks for Carl Edward Wagner, you're going to pay money for those at this point too. So just ballparking, like if you find anything for less than $10 a trade paperback, you're doing good, because a lot of the material goes for the $10 to $100 for just an old beat up paperback of his materials these days. So those are hard to get. But that said, we can circle back around. How are you guys reading these stories?
I picked it up in the sauciest covered version of the Kindle that you had sent us. It's got a very proud looking man on the front with his sword.
Mm-hmm. That's the same edition I have, the Kindle version with thirsty Fabio Kane.
Yeah, so there's the thirsty editions that are pretty accessible at the time of this recording on Amazon. It's always hard to tell with Wagner's materials, like how accessible this is, but you can get digital copies of the Kane stories in an affordable fashion. So I would recommend seeking those out if you're not lucky enough to have like physical copies of the materials. But for the love of God, if you come across anything that's got like a Kane story in it, in a half price books or a used paperback venue, and again, if it's less than $10, pick it up, because it's going to be a good read. And, you know, even if you don't care about investing in books, like it is a collectible item.
Yeah.
So in that vein, you are the one that programmed our season, Luke, and are a Kane fan. So how did you come across this character? Like, you said this is the first story you read him in. But what was
this? Was, yeah.
Okay, so this is your genesis here.
This is, yeah. So I found Kane through our show. Essentially, like, once I became, you know, awakened to the Sword and Sorcery. So dialing back 13 seasons to the start of the Chromecast, you know, we were reading the Howard materials, but we started to branch out and we talked to people, and Wagner was a name that came up. And so as I started to delve into, like, horror anthologies as like a book type that I was interested in, and the Sword and Sorcery anthologies that I was interested in, that's something that's grown over the years. So I've been able to pick up these paperbacks a few years ago. And at this point I have, if not all of the Kane stuff, most of the Kane stuff, in some various form. And so some of those are like the Barbarians 1 and 2 anthologies that collect some of the things that are in like the Book of Kane. So like Misericord and the other one, maybe those are in there, or there's a horror anthology called Dark Forces that I have a copy of, and it might be in there. But regardless, like, I've picked up most of the Kane stories, and I love Carl Edward Wagner, all of the materials that I've read. I would love to say at some point that I'm a completist, but I am far from it at this point, because he just needs to be reprinted in some sort of systematic fashion. Like, to the extent that his horror short stories can be reprinted, I would pay good money for at least like a single hardback of that. Like, really, like, more than even like a Howard collection or any old number of other pulpsters that we've talked about. Like, holy shit, if we could get a Carl Edward Wagner like horror fiction omnibus for $50 in a hardback form or $25 in a paperback form, like, that's what we need. That's what we really, like, the entire genre is kind of aching for.
Yeah, I was definitely shocked looking through some of the A Books prices and stuff of this kind of material, because it just seems like nobody will be able to get into Carl Edward Wagner's Kane unless they're willing to drop a few dimes.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
His, you know, his estate's in turmoil, and I don't want to draw a strong connection to Charles Saunders' situation right now, but like, the Amaru materials are available through print on demand, I think through Paizo, like through Amazon currently. Like, they're available. Like, you can get those stories currently, but with Saunders' demise, I don't know what will happen, like, with that sort of suite of publications. And it's a similar thing here with Wagner. It just happened some number of years previous to this that his death, my understanding, has resulted in a very complicated accessibility issue with a lot of his books. But regardless, currently, as of this recording, there are Kindle versions, digital versions of the main Kane story. So you can easily get the 3 novels and the 2 short story collections now. You know, So if anything else, pick them up for $3 a pop and you're good to go.
Yeah. But that gets into the whole, like, if you own it digitally, you don't really own it, right? Like,
right.
At any time, Amazon can say, oh, that doesn't belong on your Kindle. And
yep.
But at least, so, you're right. You can spend out about $20 and get the majority of his Kane material and at least read it and experience it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would argue, yeah, and start with a short story collection. I would argue start with Nightwinds, what we're talking about here, for this season. The reason I selected Nightwinds versus Death Angel Shadow is because there's really more stories to experience, and I thought that would be a cooler way to get into things. Death Angel Shadow is really 3 novelettes all strung together or established in that publication. And so it's more long form pieces. People really rave on and on about Reflections for the Winter of My Soul. And I wish that we could talk about that story specifically, but it's also a sequel to one of the novels. And so it seems to me, if we're going to do a sister Kane season after this one, that would be the next logical step, is to have like Dark Crusade and then Death Angel Shadow as being the 2 books that we tackle with a second season.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nightwinds is cool. It is a short story collection outright. It was published in 1978, and we're going to be working through these stories in sequence. My understanding of Kane's chronology as it is that the stories that are in Nightwind play out in a sequence relative to one another. So the next story that we would cover after tonight is a story called Two Suns Setting that would take place sometime after Undertow, and so on and so forth, right? And then we'll tackle Bloodstone, and that's the novel that we'll sort of end the season on, okay? So the take-home message with Kane is that time is relative because Kane is an immortal fixture within the landscape, in a manner of speaking. Like, he is a long-lived fellow. Is that true to say, y'all?
That's fair.
He's been here since the beginning.
Well, my understanding, his dad was here from the beginning.
Well, but his dad wasn't born here, was he?
I guess that's true.
I don't know what I'm saying. Kane is the firstborn human child, right? Like, this is a take on the Cain and Abel story with a dash of cosmic horror thrown in.
Yeah, he's definitely that first murderer. He is supposed to be him made flesh and cursed to live forever. And it seems like he's very haunted by the fact that he's still alive. We got a couple of very poignant points in the story where he's like feverishly declaring his love for the woman of the story because he just wants something to last a little longer than a blink of an eye because everything just goes by so quickly and it's not fair. He just wants her to survive. It's very interesting, the fact that he's Cain.
Yeah. He wants something beautiful to remain even for a moment. There's this really beautiful kind of gothic bit of writing in the latter part of this story where Cain is lamenting that he is doomed to watch everything die. And let's see, he says, "Did you ever wonder at the loneliness of immortality? Have you ever wondered what must be the thoughts of a man cursed to wander through the centuries? A man doomed to a desolate, unending existence, feared and hated wherever men speak his name, a man who can never know peace, whose shadow leaves ruin wherever he passes, a man who has learned that every triumph is fleeting and that every joy is transient. All that he seeks to possess is stolen away from him by the year. His empires will fall. His songs will be forgotten. His loves will turn to dust. Only the emptiness of eternity will remain with him, a laughing skeleton cloaked in memories to haunt his days and his nights."
That is such a awesome summarization of the themes of this story, specifically Undertow. Like, even like the symbols and sort of the imagery that the end of that little bit that you read, Josh, evokes is essentially the end of Undertow playing out. Mm-hmm. It is beautiful. The thing that I'll go ahead and say here, with at least the Cain that I've read, and I've only read Death Angel Shadow and Nightwind, so I have not read the novels, nor have I read the couple extra short stories that I've picked up in other anthologies. That overall summarization that you paint with Wagner's narrative, Josh, that is essentially like Wagner's world that he's presenting, right? So there's a lot of Howardian like sort of presentation of things, but the representation of death of civilization as a thing and death of cities and death of peoples, that gets brought into Cain's mythology. And I love the way that things are sort of painted, that sort of shade of darkness.
So was Wagner a Howard fan?
Yes, absolutely. So he was, you know, one of the like one of the anthologists that strove for like pure Howardian text, right, Josh?
Is that right? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, So he did. And sorry, I didn't mean to necessarily throw it to you.
That's okay. But
like, yeah. You know, he had a series of various, like sort of pure Howard editions that he spearheaded. So, specifically the Hour of the Dragon, People of the Black Circle and Red Nails they all came out like 77. And so those are things that were, I guess, edited is not necessarily the right word, but like anthologized or put together by Carl Edward Wagner. So there's forewords and afterwards in those editions that are valuable, and a lot of Howard scholars still pull from that material. But there's other things, right? Like so Carl Edward Wagner did a three-part anthology called Echoes of Valor. And so that's where you see some sort of, like, I'm using air quotes here again, like pure Howard presentations alongside other pulpsters. And the bottom line was he was someone that was concerned with sort of pulling, like, real Howard text out and presenting it to an audience. So beyond being an anthologist and writer of other materials, he's one of the first, like, heralds of Howard.
Yeah, although I did read online that when he was a kid, he didn't really get into Howard as much. It was a little bit later in his life.
Yeah, yeah. So that's indicated a couple of different places that, you know, he the Wagner spells out that his first inklings of Kane as a character actually predate his readings of Howard. Hmm. And so this just gets into the point that second generation characters like Elric certainly influenced a third generation character like Kane, right? So you kind of see this relationship across these various characters, but Howard, and specifically Conan, was not necessarily, according to Wagner, a direct influence on Kane the character.
Yeah, he was more, Wagner was more influenced by Lovecraft and maybe even Michael Moorcock and Fritz Leiber, if I understand things correctly.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of Leiber in at least, like, Undertow. I think the way that things are presented here at the first step, this seems very Leiberian with its complicated story structure even.
Yeah, and it's set in a city.
That's a good point.
Rather than being out in the countryside.
I'm intrigued to hear some of this just because I guess when I started Googling around on Carl Edward Wagner, one of the things I found was an interview where he seemed sort of derisive about sword and sorcery. And he said something about it was just chicks in bronze bikinis trying to get out of them or something. And he seemed to have not necessarily negative, I don't know how to put it. Like, he seemed to think it had fallen on hard times maybe as a genre.
I think I read online that he recounted this experience where he finished the first Kane novel when he was a senior in college. So he grows up, Wagner that is, grows up in Knoxville, Tennessee. He goes to college at Kenyon College in Ohio. And while he's at Kenyon, he begins to really take seriously this notion of writing. And Kane had been a figure that he had come up with much earlier, much younger than that. So I'm thinking late teens. And he gets this novel published when sometime between graduating from Kenyon and going to UNC at Chapel Hill. And some friends of his, or at least some classmates of his, saw him looking at the book that had this kind of provocative sword and sorcery cover and were asking, you know, make kind of poking fun at him, asking if it was pornography, you know, this and that. And I wonder if that didn't sort of sour him on the genre overall, because what I understand is that he never referred to Kane as a sword and sorcery character. He called him like acid gothic or dark fantasy and not necessarily sword and sorcery. And so I wonder if sword and sorcery at that point was, you know, we were in the glut of it with Conan knockoffs and Frazetta knockoffs with provocative covers and scantily clad ladies and big buff barbarians wearing nothing but loincloths and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're spot on. I think it's a reactionary sort of presentation of a sword and sorcery hero. This is in line as much with Elric as with any other anti-hero as we've seen within the genre. It's not like a John Jakes or a Gardner Fox presentation of a Conan knockoff. It is a response against it.
And yeah,
absolutely, the timing of it is a reflection of that. And also the publication history of Kane is something that is more horror and less sword and sorcery in a lot of ways too. Yeah. So do we want to get into the content of the story? Do we want to talk about that a little bit, guys?
Yeah.
I'm down.
So in terms of the story, I guess, what are things that y'all found most compelling with the story Undertow?
You go first, John.
The undertow of the story. It's sorrow. I mean, it's a captivity kind of thing of there's a man who is held captive by a curse ostensibly placed upon him by God, and then a woman who he has also inflicted the curse of captivity on.
Yeah. So do you think that any of the other, like the two male, I guess, quote unquote, protagonists are also captive in some sense?
Sort of. Captive by the circumstances of being in Cain's world, I guess, or getting caught up in his orbit and getting magnetized to her. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yeah, I was thinking of it in terms of her sort of, I don't know, it's a little confusing to me because she is obviously trying to find someone to rescue her from Cain. And there's a central misunderstanding on her part that becomes clear at the end of the story, but until the ending, you don't know what the deal is and what Cain is doing to sustain her. You don't get that. And it seems as though he's feeding her this potion throughout the story to bind her even tighter to him.
Right.
But in reality, that's what is sustaining her life. And it's not clear to me on if she really believes that she is being held captive and is trying to escape and is using these guys, these male protagonists to that end, or if she really doesn't remember that she is in this situation, that she is essentially being sustained and kept alive by Cain and his sorceries.
I kind of like that interpretation better, just because the idea of he's been around so long that it's possible he recruited her, or I don't even know the right word, captured her so long ago that she can't even remember that she died, that she killed herself. Like, she just has this vague, foggy memory. I think that's very evocative, that maybe she's been doing this for like 200 years, and it just makes it that much more painful.
They're both scenarios are painful in a sense. If she knows what she's doing, right, and is playing dumb,
right,
then it makes her just as malicious as Cain, in a sense, because she's immortal and thus is mentally compromised or morally compromised,
right.
And if she doesn't remember what has really happened and is doing all of this because she's afraid and is actually trying to get away, then that is tragic in a slightly different way, I think. So what was your interpretation of the story, Luke? Like, Desalyn's motivation, Cain suggests that she gets bored of her life with him and uses men to try and kill him just because it gives her a thrill. And she maintains that that is not the case.
Yeah, so I interpret this story, and I think it's really a pretty fascinating presentation of the narrative. The fact that we kind of have the stories of multiple would-be suitors presented here alongside like her birth story is complicated. And I think that Wagner's presentation of how each of those stories are distinguished is pretty clear, but unless you're an active reader of the story, it's something that you might just blow by. Like if you're expecting a Kothar barbarian swordsman story, like this is way more complicated than that.
Yes.
My interpretation of things are that, one, that we have Cain as he's not omniscient, but there's this distance between him and his I'm using air quotes love. He sees things through a different lens than what she sees because of the differences in time. But I think that she is willfully ignorant. I think there is complicity on her part for pulling these individuals into the undertow. Like they are drowned and they are damned because they happened to get mixed up with a Bad News Girl. That Bad News Girl, unfortunately, happened to get mixed up with a Bad News Guy, Kane. So I think that's part of the undertow of the story, too. But I think that she is, on some level, complicit with things. So I think that Kane is not necessarily... he's not a bad guy all the way through. He's just mostly a bad guy. He's kind of an asshole, but at the end, he ultimately acts in a non-anti-hero fashion. So we get it, like, the issue of Wagner not subscribing to Kane being an anti-hero. Here, at the end of the story, Kane actually grants Dizelin her wish and acts in a relatively heroic fashion. Only it's kind of a very gothic sort of end to the story, but I like that he releases her.
You are not, you are a bad guy, but you are not bad guy.
I love it. And so that's how Kane's presented. That's how Dizelin is presented. I will say that nobody's good in this story, right? Like, the two other dudes, so we've got Mavrasol and Dragar, like those two different, air quotes again, protagonists, they're kind of douches. They're kind of bros. They're like bros. They're like sword and sorcery bros that think they're going to whip up on Kane. So this is, I'm going to put a pin in this and we'll circle back around to it, because it's the cool thing that I think is a very cool, like, starting the season with this story is a cool thing to do, the same way that you might start Conan with Phoenix on the Sword. But the two dudes, Dragar and Mavrasol, they're kind of bro dudes, and they underestimate Kane, and Kane ain't gonna be effed around with, and he throws down, and he slaughters and he slays and he does what he does, because that's what the left-handed, like, son of man is gonna do, and they get what's coming to him. So nobody's good, in my opinion.
Yeah, nobody's good. Sorry, John, go.
Oh, I was just gonna say I totally agree, just because there's a part where the young barbarian in particular, I think, says something about, look at the man I've cuckolded. He's obviously proud of what he's done. Like, he's complicit in this cheating love triangle kind of thing. He gets off on that a little bit. So yeah, no, there's no good guy in this whole story.
In Dragar's mind, Kane is a wizened old man hiding in his wizard's tower.
Right.
And that is not the case. Kane is a man who is forever going to be in his prime. Described as just being massive and not necessarily a giant. Dragar is taller, but Kane is broader, right? I really liked Dragar the Barbarian, and I was going to say that both Dragar and Mavrasol, those two did pretty well against Kane.
It's true. They get their licks in.
They weren't. I don't think they were necessarily slaughtered. I think that they were outgunned from the beginning, but they both held their own for a little while, which was surprising to me. I expected Kane to come in during these two scenes where we had these combats and just pop utterly like destroy. Groups. Yes,
but there is some level of, like, I'm going to slowly choke this son of a bitch so he experiences his death. Kind of like Kane is a sadist.
Yeah, for sure.
The original sadist.
Yeah, right. But you're right. Like, Kane is aged, but so circling around to this thing. So were you guys expecting to see, like, this character of Kane, wizard's robes in the center of town in this, like, dark, deep, necromantic world? Like, is this what you were expecting when you got into the story?
I expected less of a focus on his wizarding and sorcery, and more of a focus on his steely thews and pantherish guile. And I was delighted by the fact that he is in equal parts a scholar of the dark arts and a barbaric sort of fighter in the same vein as we see in other tales, like Conan specifically.
I was definitely caught unawares by this story. I mean, based just on the covers I had seen, that painting that Josh has mentioned, I had a very definitive expectation of what we were going to read, and it was not a magic dude descent, or that was the cursed man of God. Like, I didn't see any of that coming. I did not see it coming that he is the villain of the story, ostensibly, and I was kind of blown out of the water by some of it. I was like, oh, wow, okay, all right, we're working in a very different realm right now.
Yeah, so this collection, the Night Winds collection, I like it very much because it presents Kane in a variety of, like, visages. Like, the same way that we see Conan as the freebooter, Conan as the king, Conan as the rogue, you know, we are going to see over the next half dozen stories, Kane in a variety of different presentations. And I love that we start out with, like, Kane as an aged old necromancer, but he's really not that. That's just, like, the draperies that are around him. It's just, it's cool to emphasize that this character is more than just, as Josh indicated, like, the Steely Thews. It's not necessarily the classic barbarian. Of course, there's so much to be unpacked here with, like, how Wagner deals with his anti-hero.
It's cool. It's as if you took Conan from, like, his king days and melded him with Thothamon and his sorcery. It's very cool. I like it a lot.
Cool.
Another thing I really liked was, and I don't know if the print version has this, but at the end of each chapter, there's like an italicized little passage.
And yep, that's
my favorite is Kane is talking to Desolyn, and they're all conversations with Desolyn, but this one's my favorite, and it starts with "How many times, Desolyn?" And it's very, very poetic, very cool. "How many times, Desolyn? How many times will you play this game? But this was the first. The first. Are you sure, Desolyn? I swear it. How can I be sure? And how many after? How many circles, Desolyn? Circles? Why this darkness in my mind? How many times, Desolyn, have you played at Lorelei? How many are those who have known your summoning eye? How many are those who have heard your siren cry, Desolyn? How many souls have swum out to you, Desolyn, and perished by the shadows that hide below and are drawn down to hell by the undertow? How many times, Desolyn? I can't remember." It's so good. It's as if it were taken directly out of, like, the Vampire the Masquerade source book or something. Like, it's so good.
Nice. I'm excited. We're just, like, scratching the surface here, obviously, but this is our introductory episode for the season, so we've got a lot of time to talk about subsequent Kane stories, obviously.
For sure.
Like, let's go ahead and try to wrap things up. Are there other things that you all would want to hit on here before we put a pin in it?
Let's go around everybody with one more thing they like.
All right.
I like the magical sword that Dragar has, the Wizard's Bane. This is, you know, time and time again, I come back to this question of what is sword and sorcery. You know, it's always sort of prefaced with, often there is low magic. Often the stakes are such and such. Often, you know, that's all to say that there are no hard and fast rules. That is an episode for another day. But the fact that Dragar has this magical sword that has the capability to nullify magic, that has the capability to launch what is essentially a magical bolt, right, that he uses to fry whatever Kane's creature was that he sent after Desolyn, is just so cool to me. I think that this is a sword and sorcery story. And if you talk to other people, they might say, well, because he has this magic sword that does all this magic stuff, then it's not sword and sorcery. And to those who might say that, I say, bollocks.
John, Do you want to go next, or do you want me to take it?
Yeah, no, I'll go.
Okay, go for it.
There's a couple of instances where they focus in on people's eyes, and there's definitely an emphasis on the fact that Kane has these piercing, otherworldly blue eyes, and the idea that this is the mark of Kane was something that intrigued me. We texted about this earlier today, where I started looking up stuff about the mark of Kane, because I remember as a boy being talked to about that Kane's face was blackened, or that Kane had a tattoo of a Hebrew sigil sort of imprinted on his forearm that people could always recognize. But there is also a school of thought that Cain's blue eyes in this story are part of the curse of Cain, that Cain was given these blue eyes as a marker of his sin, of his curse from God, and that people of blue-eyed descent from him are sons of Cain, sort of. I found that interesting. I found it interesting that there were multiple times where we're like given this window into the souls of characters, where I think we focus in on the pirate Marvisol's eyes, and they talk about how honey brown they are and the things that he's thinking. And then Kane's eyes are multiple times referenced, just how blue they are. And then times where they're very tired and rimmed with pain, and it looks like he's been crying and staying up too long and is weak. I just enjoyed the focus on eyes. I thought it was a very interesting touch to the story.
Can we talk for just 1 second about the mark of Cain?
Yeah, sure.
So I remember learning about the mark of Cain just from Bible study stuff I used to read when I was a kid. But I never really looked at it that closely. And so today when we were chatting, I took a deep dive into this, and there are two things that I learned. And one of them is that in some Christian traditions, Cain made it to the moon with a bundle of sticks and lives on the moon.
Who can blame him?
Yeah. And according to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Cain is a dark, hairy man who lives in Tennessee.
We could go see him.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's just one state south.
It's a bad state. We don't really want to go to it. I feel bad for him that he lives there.
Why is it a bad state? That's where our buddy Ed lives.
Yeah, but you've seen how their football team dresses. It's not a great state.
Oh, man. Their poor football team this year. If UK beats you, you know, it's over for you.
I also was very interested in this Mark of Cain stuff, like we were texting about earlier. I was intrigued by, I'm always intrigued by whenever we do a season, whenever we do anything on the Chromecast, finding these people that have built sort of almost out of a pulp tradition, the secret history of the world, and finding out that people view the Mark of Cain as this blue-eyed sort of weirdness. I don't know. I liked it, but it doesn't have any bearing on the story. Luke, take us home on what was the thing that you liked most about the tale.
So the thing that I like about Undertow is that it's like a series of two or three different stories that are all nested with one another, within one another. And so it's kind of a retelling of the same tale multiple times. That's like the central theme. So I think that Wagner, he hits out of the park making a literary sword and sorcery story here. I think that having the elements that he does with sort of a femme fatale and Cain as this anti-hero and his two like bro dude sword and sorcery buffs, it is a sword and sorcery story, but it's also a horror story that is being experienced by Desolin. And I think that it's pretty beautiful the way that things play out. It's not necessarily an easy read. I mean, it's not like an overly complicated story. Like, I don't want to paint it that way, but it is a story that has like layers of narrative within it, and you've got to be paying attention to what story is playing out when. And I think that's super cool. So I really like that. And then the thing that I like beyond the characters and beyond the sort of narrative is the concept of like the doomed and the damned civilizational decay that's playing out almost the same way that we're seeing the decay of any one character. But again, this is like Cain, and this is like Wagner in a nutshell, that we're seeing like the decay of people over time. I love that this city is so damned and so horrible, and we're seeing that presentation of things within this story. And we'll come back to that across like various stories over the season.
The city does seem to be a character again, just like we encountered with Fawford and Gray Mouser.
Yeah. It's not always that case. The same way that Fawford and Mouser like range afar, and then maybe they'll end up back at a city. Like, we see variation in where the stories will take place. And in fact, like, our next story is like kind of a wilderness story, which I'm pretty excited about as a good juxtaposition. Again, I think that Nightwinds is a stellar collection because all of the stories are so very different. So like moving into Tucson setting, it is a very different Cain story than what we're talking about here. And it's a bit more traditional, and it's like sword and sorcery archetypes that we'll talk about. But there's variation. You're going to see a lot of like effed up cities and effed up civilizations by the time this season's over with.
I'm excited.
Woo, me too. I'm glad. That makes me happy. I don't want you guys to be like put out or tired with this material. I hope that it's not too much of a downer, but I really have been excited to talk about Cain like for a good long while. So I'm glad that we're getting into it.
2020 has broken me down to the point where this is perfect for me to read right now.
this is gonna tap into that vein that you need to get into to feel alive again.
To let bleed so I can live.
Jesus. If our listeners have been similarly broken down to their constituent particles, and they want to listen to us on other places, what or other things that we've talked about, where can they find us, Josh?
You can find us on the web at thecromcast.blogspot.com, where all of our archive is hosted. We are also on Twitter at thecromcast, and we are on Facebook and Instagram, likewise at thecromcast. Please call us, 859-429-CROM. Tell us about your immortal experiences and how the world has ground you down to your very existential core.
And if you have any experiences with Cain or Carl Edward Wagner, we would love to hear those as well. We're always interested in hearing people's personal histories with the reading material that we're devouring throughout our seasons.
Definitely.
Truth. All right. So with that, folks, you can join us a little bit further down the road of Cain, the dark and lonely road, the left-handed path. I don't know quite what we're calling this season.
I like the left-handed path. I like that.
He is the left-handed one. That's where he's walking.
It does make reference to his left-handedness a lot, doesn't it?
He's a lefty swordsman.
Yeah.
That will come up. Yeah. Yep.
And next time is Two Suns Setting, the next story in Nightwinds.
That's right. Cain out in the hinterlands, and he's going to have an encounter, and it'll be a civilizational story sort of in a different context. I'm excited, dudes.
Cain rules for initiative.
I know my